So welcome to Elevenses with Danielle Perry, the podcast where we embrace the tradition of a mid-morning break. We take time to put the smartphones down and also make time for some proper conversation. Now, the crux of this podcast is that over Elevenses, I ask each of my guests the same 11 questions. And it's already revealing some wildly different answers, exactly as I'd hoped for. My guest today is someone I've watched on screen for years. I've fallen off sofas laughing at him, and one of his creations was a steadfast entertainment companion in my student houses in my university days. He's an English actor, a voiceover artist, a writer, producer, and production company owner. From starting his career in the 1980s as a voiceover artist on Spitting Image and creating the one and only Alan Partridge, to travelling with Rob Brydon on The Trip and also playing the lead in Greed, a film that came out at the start of 2020, a satire on the mega rich. We met pre-lockdown and very quickly squeezed a coffee into his schedule before he was whisked off to another appointment. So if the intro didn't give it away, please welcome my next guest for Elevenses, the brilliant Steve Coogan.
Very well indeed, yeah.
Good, it's lovely to see you after watching you for so many years. It's lovely to meet you in person.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. So you're all right for a brew? You've got one?
I've got my coffee here, so that'll do me fine.
Coffee's the thing, first thing for you, is it?
It is, yeah. And then I think two coffees are good, and then after that, it starts to get a bit jittery, so I go on to tea after that.
Exactly. You can be coffeed out quite quickly.
You can, yeah.
Now, what we're going to do is we're going to sort of explore a little bit, because I think sometimes we lose the art of conversation these days. Mm-hmm. Everyone's sort of addicted to their smartphones. So if we could rewind back to your childhood, I'd love to know what your first memory is.
My first memory is the two things that stick in my mind are I had meningitis when I was two, so I was in hospital, and I remember a very friendly nurse, and I remember she had a nice face.
Right.
I was about two. And then the other memory when I was three was being at a fun fair and hearing Peter Sarsted's "Where Do You Go To, My Lovely?" blasting out through the speakers.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah. So it's emotion and sensory stuff, really, that you remember so clearly, isn't
it? Yeah. It's funny how those things sort of stick. I got lost at the market when I was about two as well, two and a half.
Right.
When, you know, in sort of, I lost my mum, and I remember walking and tugging on coats of ladies, and they'd turn around, and I remember thinking, I want this. When the woman turns around, I want it to be my mum, and it wasn't. It being me being terrified.
Wow, fascinating. It's amazing how vibrant they still are in your mind,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
incredible. Yeah. And I know that all your brothers as well went into sort of the entertainment industry, didn't they? Music, the Mock Turtles, also Top Gear. I believe
My brother Brendan was briefly a Top Gear presenter and did a lot of presenting on sort of these cable channels when they were in their those fledgling days. And my brother Martin had a moment in the early 90s on the back of the Manchester thing with his band, the Mock Turtles.
Yeah.
And so growing up, my older brother Martin was sort of, he set the tone because he was into cool music, and he sort of, it was always encouraged me to not look at mainstream entertainment, but look at the stuff that was slightly to the left
or
slightly off-piste. And that set me up quite well, because it meant my taste in entertainment was always a little different, and taught me that, you know, it was better to be original than just to follow the crowd. And that sort of served me well, I think, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you were younger, I've read that you found that you were great at impersonations and impressions as well. What piece of advice would you give your younger self, like looking back? Maybe not that young, but in your teenage years, or?
I think to trust my intuition. I suppose because I sort of had slight, I would always think there were people who were cleverer than me, and I wasn't, I had this talent, but I felt like I wasn't intellectual enough. And if I was talking to myself, I'd tell myself to trust my intuition about things, and probably to aim a bit higher. I think strive for excellence. I think because it's something that sort of I've had to learn through the years.
Mm.
But so oftentimes you get advice when your career starts to gather momentum. People give you advice, and the advice you know, what I've learned is more often than not, you might as well trust your feelings about something than necessarily heed advice. And so it's something I've learned to trust my instincts more as I've gotten older.
It's funny, isn't it? I would say the same to myself, actually, because it's like a confidence, isn't it? And you can see where you've made these strange turns that maybe didn't feel quite right at the time and everything. And it's quite a nice thing about aging, isn't it? Where you have that confidence in yourself, I think.
Yeah, to sort of listen to yourself. And and also sort of, I think it's always good to stretch yourself a bit. Try and do things that are slightly outside your comfort zone. There's nothing wrong with failing.
Yeah.
As long as you learn something from it. And it's always better to, as I say, to roll the dice and take some risks professionally than always play it safe. To do interesting work, you have to risk failure. So I've learned that too. So to not be worried about, or as it were, to get comfortable with feeling a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, right. Okay, now that's interesting. So, like, pushing yourself and not being afraid of failure is actually quite a brave manoeuvre, the more I think about it. And I'm not sure if I've been that brave yet, so total work in progress. But that does lead on quite nicely to my next question, which is simple yet pointed. Are you scared of anything, Steve?
Am I scared of anything? Am I scared of anything? Well, I mean, I'm scared of heights, but I'm not really scared of. I suppose I'm scared of people, of losing people I love. Like a lot of people are, you know. I'm not really scared for myself, but people. I don't want people I love to suffer in any way, or anything bad to happen to them. So I have a fear. That's sort of a fear I have, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Has the heights thing ever, has that ever caused problems filming? Anything? Have you ever had to have like a stunt double or something do anything?
No, it's the looking over balconies and things like that that always terrifies me, because you know that you could sort of, it would be so easy to sort of just step off and there's part of you that thinks I don't like what it does to your brain,
you know?
It's scary.
When we were talking about just then the confidence of sort of looking back at your career and trusting your gut as well, what would you consider your greatest achievement in life or career? Or
I think it's funny you should say that, because we just filmed a new series of The Trip, and Rob Brydon asks me the same question in The Trip.
Is this one in Greece?
The one in Greece. And Rob says, I have to say, part of this was pre-planned.
Okay.
He said, what would be your greatest achievement? I said, well, my 7 BAFTAs. He said, mine would be my children. And I said, well, that's because you haven't won any BAFTAs.
Yeah, exactly.
But I didn't mean.
Touché.
But we only decided that I would say that because it sets up the kind of call and response thing. Of course, I think my greatest achievement is my BAFTAs. It would be a pretty shallow thing. I think that, you know, beyond. I think, like with any of these things, you know, to be truthful, it's to be to try and be kind, and to try and. My father once said, if you borrow something, you should give it back in a better condition than when you borrowed it. Mm. And I feel like that when we're on this earth, you should try and. If you can't in some way add to the sum total of human happiness, then it's sort of a waste of time in your life. And I think that there is something about making people laugh which is a gift, and is something which as I've gotten older, I mean, I was probably more dismissive of it when I'm younger, but as I get older I realise that, you know, when we have problems or we're dealing with things either as a group or as individuals, often the only comfort left is laughter. And so I sort of treat it with more respect now that whoever practices it than I did when I was young. And I think there is something quite special about that, about trying to it's an old cliche about laughter being the best medicine, but I think it is profoundly true.
I agree.
So I think that even though I've done more serious stuff occasionally, I think and even in the sort of serious stuff I've done, I think using humour to sugar the pill of different topics, and really, you know, I mean, comedy is how you sugar the pill of life, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally. Now, we just mentioned Rob Brydon. Now, you've had a fantastic working relationship with him over the years. Who's your best friend?
Mike.
Who's Mike? Tell us about Mike.
Mike.
If you're allowed.
Mike Taylor is, my gosh, yeah. Well, I've known him since I was 11.
Yeah.
And Mike used to, at one point, produce Blind Date. Remember the TV show?
Blind Date.
And but he stepped away from that, and he sort of basically like leads a nomadic life now, where he just travels around the world, living out of a knapsack.
Right.
And he trained himself to fly a Microlite and service a Land Rover, and spent a year driving across Africa by himself. And so he leads this strange nomadic life, but he always comes back and. And stays with me, and then goes off on his adventures. I feel like I'm living vicariously through him.
Yeah.
Because I also he's not like he's not that rich. He sort of just gets he gets by.
Yeah, yeah.
But I sometimes think he's having a better life than me with my sort of wealth and success, because he's the one that's sort of out there sort of enjoying life, while I'm, with the greatest respect, sort of popping around radio studios about myself, which, you know, has limited appeal.
Yeah, he's having a coffee in somewhere beautiful like Costa Rica or something right now.
Well, where is he now? Is he in the Caribbean or somewhere? Then he was in Machu Picchu, and then he was in the Galapagos Isles, and then I went to see him in Buenos Aires about 6 months ago, and that was
great.
Where he just happened to be. It's like, so he's trying to consume the world.
Yeah, Mike sounds great. Mm. I like the sound of Mike. So this might correlate now with the next question, which is, when were you at your happiest in your life, do you think? Is that certain moments with Mike or your childhood or with your brothers?
Well, I think it's strange looking back at your childhood, because, of course, it's only in retrospect you realise sort of how idyllic it was. But I think, yes, I had a blessed childhood. It was sort of a childhood of riding bikes and getting knees scuffed and, enjoying my favourite TV shows and listening to vinyl records of comedy that I liked, and then going on holiday to Ireland. It was things that were quite sort of ordinary in many respects, and just days out with my brothers and friends. And so I think my childhood was quite idyllic and... I just did normal things. I had a normal, healthy childhood, and in a very sort of raised in a very sort of loving environment. And I did those normal things that I had a paper round. I remember the handlebars on my bicycle that I built myself with. So I put on handlebars that were too wide to go down a narrow passageway on my paper round. So I had to go the long way round, because I couldn't get through. The handlebars I put on were just way too wide. Unremarkable in many ways, but really enjoyable. But then, having said that, I think as I get older, I get happier and more grateful for the life I've been able to lead. And that I'm able to make choices, and many people can't make those choices. So I feel... grateful that I'm able to do things that I enjoy, that other people enjoy, and that the people around me are healthy and happy. Now in my childhood, and the in-between stuff is a bit annoying.
Okay, no, fair enough. Do you have reoccurring dreams?
Yes, I do. Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, I do. I have one where I am back at school, and I'm about to sit my A-levels again.
Mm.
And for some reason, I'm sitting physics A-level, which I never did, and I haven't done any revision. And the thing is, it's not as if... people say, you've had this successful career for 30 years, taken time out from school, and now you've come back because you haven't finished doing your A-levels, and I'm terrified. And then I wake up in this sort of sweat, and I'm really... And the other one, of course, is going on stage to... to do, I don't know, a play of some sort, and sometimes it's Shakespeare, and they say, you're on stage in an hour. And I say, that's not long enough to learn all the lines. And an hour isn't long enough. Yeah. It's not possible. I can't do it.
Oh, wow.
They say, well, you have to go on holding the book. And I thought, I'm going to look like an idiot. And they're also anxiety dreams. Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you still love the thrill of live, or do you prefer screen and...
Well, it's funny enough, I do enjoy performing. It's a while since I've actually done a live show. It's 10 years. And I miss it. I sort of do it every 10 years. So I think in the next couple of years, I'll take a big live Alan Partridge show on the road.
Oh, great. Probably
maybe in a couple of years' time. Because there is something, you know, sometimes it's a bit of a slog, but there's something wonderful about being... there's no filter between you and the audience.
Right.
They're right in front of you, and you either make them laugh or you don't. And if you do, then you get this sort of wave of adulation that comes towards you, and it's all happening there and then in that space, and it's quite magical. And so when I've been starved of it for a long time, I feel like I want to go back there. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, I know that when we were speaking at the start of our coffee, you said one of your earliest memories was of music. And with my next question, I'm after a piece of music or maybe even a piece of art that completely takes your breath away. Something which you return to again and again. You know, the ones you get pretty obsessed with. Gut-wrenching, emotional stuff. Would you be so kind to share that with us?
Well, it sort of changes from time to time. There's a song by Fairport Convention called Farewell that I sort of fell in love with again recently. The Stone Ponies, Different Drum. I was listening to that recently. Mm. That's all old stuff, really, I'm afraid.
No.
And there's, like, you know, Roberta Flack, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
Oh, it's beautiful.
There's so many. There's... I tell you what I was listening to. There's a film composer who died a few years ago called Johan Johansson.
Mm, I know.
And he did a piece of music called IBM 1401, A User's Manual. That's the name of the album.
Right.
And it's inspired by the fact that his father was a computer engineer, and my father was a computer engineer. And what I love about it is finding the humanity in what are essentially inhumane things. And he sort of, I think he talked about this composition, about holding a retirement party for this IBM computer that had been put out of service, put out to grass, as it were.
Yeah.
And that these engineers stood around with glasses of wine toasting the computer. And I found that so touching. And then the piece of music that he develops from that is really moving, very profound. I love that. And I love Ennio Morricone's score for Cinema Paradiso is something I absolutely adore. Mm. John Barry's score for Walkabout, the Nick Rogue film with Jenny Agutter, is something I can listen to endlessly that really lifts my spirits. Yeah,
They're all incredible composers, aren't they?
Just,
yeah, wonderful. We're just coming to the last question now, Steve. And of course, I went to see Greed a few days ago, which is your new film coming out, which of course is a terrible quality in people. Sometimes, especially portrayed in that film as well. I found it a roller coaster of emotions where it was really funny, it was very thought provoking, uncomfortable in places. I've thought about it a lot after seeing
great.
It, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And this might be quite a pointed question off the back of it, but what is your worst quality, do you think, as a person?
I think it is, I really have to. is judging people. I mean, not in sort of being slightly. Trying, you know, I remember once I was on the tube, and years ago, and I was sat opposite. Normally, it's sort of an inverted snobbery, I think I have.
Right.
I was on the tube, and it was a really hot day, and everyone was one of the things. No air conditioning. People are sweating, and a baby was crying very loudly, really loudly.
Yeah.
And there was a guy sat opposite me. Had a pinstripe suit, tailored, very sharp, handkerchief, reading the Financial Times with his umbrella, and looked really, really, really sharp. But I sort of, I remember looking at him, thinking, I don't like people like you who are all, you know, driven by money, and that's all you think about, and you spend all this money on a suit, and there's people starving. Ugh. I was thinking all this was going through my head, and the baby started crying really quite loudly. And then this guy who was standing down the carriageway, who had sort of sandals on and a beard, and someone I thought might thought I'd have more affinity with, said, "Shut that baby up!" and screamed at the baby. And then the man in the pinstripe suit said, "Do you mind not talking to that woman like that? You know, babies cry for a reason, and you know, we're all hot in here and nobody likes it. And if you don't, if you can't put up with that, I suggest you move to another carriage." And everyone broke into a round of applause.
Oh, good for
and
him.
I'm thinking that the guy I'd judged in my own mind was I'd decided who he was without knowing him.
Right.
And that stuck in my mind years later, not to wait and to let to you know, to give people the benefit of the doubt and not be so internally admonishing.
I used to do the same. I used to be a backpacker in the supermarket and I would judge what people would be like, "This is all terrible for you." And, you know, I'd be like, "You shouldn't be feeding that to your children. I mean, it's awful, but you do it." Thank you so much for all the comedy in the films. Philomena, I was a massive fan of that. Alan Partridge, first time I saw it, it was for, I think it was Children in Need, and my mum and she was going to write to the BBC to complain because she thought she didn't get the
part. Well, I have in my downstairs toilet, I have a letter of complaint to the BBC made in 1992 about why have you let this appalling man on Radio 4? It's a disgrace.
And when I saw Alpha Papa, it just really brought back, you know, I started in local radio making the tea, even the Royal Blue pin badges on the set. I was like, that's it. He's absolutely nailed it. Steve Coogan, thank you so much for sharing 11s with me. It's been a joy to meet you.
Yeah, for me too.
Thank you so much. Oh man, Steve Coogan. Chatting to him was a bit strange, actually, because I'd watched him for so many years. To be opposite that face that you've been entertained by for so long was quite the honour. It really, really was. I was also chatting to him on the day of the Greed premiere, and we literally had a 20-minute window. So as much as I sped up and pretended to not notice the time, sadly, we only marked off 9 questions of the list. But I'm sure we will cross paths again soon, perhaps on the Alan Partridge live show he promised, which is en route in the next couple of years, apparently. I did, though, love meeting the man behind so many characters I grew up with. I've been tainted by friends continuously shouting "Jan!" At me across busy car parks for most of my life after one of his particular scenes for Alan Partridge. But such a talent, and I love seeing his more personal side away from the comedy, like hearing about his best friend Mike and plans for the future. It's an absolute legend. So if you enjoyed this podcast, please do subscribe. Give us a rating if you'd be so kind. It all really, really helps. Up next, I'm joined by Sophie Dahl for a hot beverage as we continue our 11 questions. We caught up mid-lockdown, actually, and things seem to be getting a little out of hand, a bit wild in their Buckinghamshire home.
Watching endless Tiger King, and then my husband sort of was endlessly wearing leopard print, so it all got very
very weird. Week 3 in lockdown.
Yeah. Cosplay at the Columns. Yeah. I was Carol Baskin and he was Joe Exotic.
So see you next time for our next brew. Can't wait. Thanks for listening.